From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Wednesday, at a press conference in Tehran, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad announced he was bestowing a gift on the British people by releasing 15 British naval officers detained in Iran for nearly 2 weeks. By Thursday, they were home. But if this was, as many suggest, some kind of bizarro power play, who won? We asked Los Angeles Times Mideast correspondent Borzu Daragahi, who covered the story from Tehran and then from Cairo, where he is now. He told us that satellite TV outlets in the region approached the situation with far cooler heads than the Western media. That, in fact,
they were basically just presenting this as a simple border dispute. And so it was very sympathetic to the Iranian point of view, both on the Jazeera and Arabia network and in the newspapers. Another interesting point was the sort of suggestion that they were being paraded about. It was not reflected in the way Arabs and Iranians saw this. They didn't see it as a humiliation of the British soldiers. They saw them being well-treated and, you know, treated as guests, and they interpreted it very differently than Tony Blair interpreted it, which was as a violation of international law.
Although the Geneva Convention expressly forbids using captives or detainees for any kind of propaganda purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. Personally, I think this definitely crossed the line. But in the eyes of many people, it was rather comic and light, you know, with how relaxed they were eating pistachios and so on. People thought it was rather amusing.
Is it fair to say that the reaction to the story in the press reflected just a general hostility and suspicion towards Britain and the West, as opposed to the particulars of this incident?
I think that's absolutely the case. And as a matter of fact, depending on how anti-American the media outlet was, is just how sympathetically Iran was portrayed in this whole thing. For example, Al Arabiya, which is the number two Arabic language news channel in the world, it's partly owned by the Saudis, who are concerned about Iran's rising influence in the region, was much more balanced in its coverage with regard to who was in the right and who was portrayed positively. On the other hand, Al Jazeera, which is more oriented toward the rest of the Arab world, it portrayed Ahmadinejad very, very positively. And as a matter of fact, emphasized the fact that Ahmadinejad was releasing these guys as an act of charity. And it kept saying that over and over again, what a nice, generous guy this is for releasing these sailors as an act of forgiveness in the spirit of the Prophet Muhammad.
There's a recurring theme in Western coverage, and that is that this is a Pyrrhic victory for Ahmadinejad, because while he may have gained short-term advantage by humiliating Britain, it just further isolates Iran politically and economically from the West. Did you hear any of that in the analysis in the regional media?
You know, where I read it a lot was in the Iranian press. A lot of the moderates in Iran, a lot of the more opposition figures who are tolerated and they publish newspapers and publish columns and blogs and so on. There was a lot of concern about that Ahmadinejad will score his quick, easy, cheap nationalist victory, but harm Iran's interests in the long run. It wasn't in the broadcast outlets, because in Iran, the broadcast outlets are controlled by the most conservative elements in the government, but it was definitely in the newspapers.
It seems to me that historically, if Arab countries, or in this case, Iran, are defiant of the West and stand up to the West, no matter how self-defeating, they get credit in the region for being a player. Is Ahmadinejad more of a player in the Mideast for having captured a boat full of young sailors?
I think that's basically what happened here. He defied the West. He stuck a thumb in the eye of Britain, which has a long and storied history in the Middle East, resented by a lot of people here locally. And he got away with it, and he sent a message in the eyes of many people to the West that we are a regional power and we will not allow you to violate our territory. That's how many people here view this, as Iran standing up for its rights.
When you're covering these stories in the Middle East, stories about opinion towards the West, do you feel like arguing with the people you're interviewing with and sort of setting them straight, or does it make you sort of question your own assumptions about how the world works?
Well, I mean, I constantly try to question my own assumptions about how the world works, but I definitely question constantly in their face. It's part of the fun of this job of confronting people occasionally is like, look, how can you be so anti-Western and you're wearing like Adidas running shoes and you're watching The Simpsons and you're cracking up? Don't you see a contradiction there? So I'm always engaging in debates like that with people, and it's part of what makes the job so interesting.
Okay, Borzu. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Borzu Daragahi is a Mideast correspondent for the Los Angeles Times.
4 weeks ago, BBC correspondent Alan Johnston was kidnapped by masked gunmen in the Palestinian region of Gaza, where he'd been living and working for 3 years. Often journalists are placed or place themselves in danger, usually without much note. But Johnston's case is unusual. The loudest voices protesting his plight have not been those of the Western media, but of local Palestinian reporters. The Palestinian Journalists Syndicate organized a 3-day strike this past week. On Tuesday, reporters declined to cover a meeting between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Representative Nancy Pelosi, and on Wednesday, they blocked the entrance to the Parliament building, ending that day's legislative session. There was also a demonstration on Thursday. Why has the kidnapping of this reporter generated so much outrage? And why now? We ask Nidal al-Megrabi, a Palestinian reporter for Reuters, who helped organize the strike.
It has come to be like enough is enough. For Palestinian journalists, they have had enough of the attacks on the local journalists and the foreign journalists. So the kidnapping of Alan Johnston had to be met by a different response from the previous ones, which were limited to one protest or one rally. We have decided to establish a committee to protect journalists in Gaza and the West Bank in support and solidarity with Alan Johnston, and also in the demand for the Palestinian Authority to take action, because we believe that the recurrence of these kidnappings resulted from the fact that no kidnappers involved in the previous kidnappings were brought to justice.
After nearly a dozen journalists have been captured, released, their kidnappers have suffered no consequences, you're directing your anger at the Palestinian Authority. But do you think that the Palestinian Authority really has any power in a situation like this?
We have about 70,000 Palestinian security forces who are loyal to President Mahmoud Abbas from Fatah. And we also have about 6,000 who are loyal to Hamas government as well. So we are not in need for more security forces.
Fair enough. But do these forces know exactly who it is has kidnapped, say, Alan Johnston?
We have a reason to believe that they know because of the experience. And according to all human rights groups, in the past cases, you know, the kidnappers were known to the Palestinian security forces. So I don't think that we are lacking the military power to put an end to this, but we are lacking the political will.
And so you're trying to influence that political decision with demonstrations like the one you participated in on Thursday. What kind of impact do you think your demonstration had on the decision makers?
I would say there will be a positive impact. For 20 days, we have been trying to raise the public awareness. We have established a tent in the middle of Gaza City, decorated with posters of Alan, and we have been visited by hundreds and hundreds of people, and we have insisted that we will not leave the ground outside the office of President Abbas until he comes and speaks to us. And he came and he spoke to us, and he hinted that him and the Prime Minister Haniyeh from Hamas have laid down the final plan to get Alan Johnston released by all legitimate means, as he said. He declined to elaborate on what means he will take, but I have a feeling that the case, hopefully, is coming to an end.
We spoke to you earlier, and you said that Palestinian journalists aren't just demonstrating for Alan Johnston, they're also demonstrating for themselves.
That is true. Many of our colleagues have been beaten up by either police or by Palestinian unknown gunmen in the streets because of something that they have said in a television show or something they have written in a newspaper. While we are demonstrating, you know, for Alan, we are also standing by ourselves. We are trying to say that we will no longer take these insults. We are also saying clearly that what will happen if the foreign journalists leave Gaza Strip and do not come at all.
And what does it mean for Gaza if Western journalists can't work there?
It means that Gaza will be forgotten. It means that this area may turn into another Somalia or may be classified as Iraq, for instance. And this is a disaster for the Gaza Strip people, and it is a disaster for the economy.
We spoke earlier this week with an editor from Al-Quds, which is a major Arabic language daily based in East Jerusalem, and he told us that they weren't participating in the strike this week because their readers expect them to report the news. Are you sympathetic to that position?
Not at all. Not at all. When somebody violates the strike, I would say he violates his own rights. When somebody turns on the television, when he turns on the radio, when he opens the news server and he doesn't see any news coming from Gaza, he will wonder what is happening. And he will know the journalists are on strike because they are calling for their freedom.
But Nida, what about the argument that the journalist's first responsibility is to his or her readers or viewers, that their first job is to report the news?
Absolutely. But I would say, how are you going to function when you know that there is no security? How are you going to be in the streets when you know that one of your colleagues has been kidnapped? How are you going to work when you know that there is no immunity for you as a journalist? If somebody attacks you, no problem. Nobody cares. If somebody abducts you, nobody cares. Somebody has to scream. Somebody has to cry. Somebody has to shout. We have started our campaign for Alan Johnston, but Alan Johnston is the title or the, let's say, code name for our campaign. Our campaign is going to continue even after Alan Johnston is released to protect our rights and to protect the general freedoms as well.
All right. Nidal, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Nidal Al-Megrabi is a Gaza-based reporter for Reuters.
Coming up, the Left Behind series concludes with one last rapturous novel and a training camp for media saboteurs.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. While retail sales of music have dropped precipitously in recent years, one of the few bright spots has been the online song sales on sites like iTunes. But the transition to this new marketplace hasn't been altogether smooth. Nervous major labels have created elaborate digital locks to prevent online piracy. They call the locking software Digital Rights Management, or DRMs. Critics say DRMs prohibit consumers from doing with their music what they'd like, including, say, playing it on non-Apple products. This week came the first real move towards breaking that impasse. Apple announced a deal with music company EMI to sell all of EMI's music, minus the Beatles, DRM-free, allowing consumers to play their music whenever and on whatever they like. Ryan Block is the managing editor of the tech website Engadget, and he's cautiously optimistic about the deal. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want you to tell me why you and others are so dead set against DRM to begin with.
Well, I think that it kind of shows a fundamental lack of trust for the consumers that they're selling to. And if you think about the kind of analogs in some of the other media that you consume, it would kind of be like if you walk into a store and you buy a CD and then you get home and you realize that CD can only be played in a Sony CD player. Or if you're watching ABC and you don't get a signal because ABC only tunes on RCA televisions. It's not really a very good consumer experience. And if I download something on iTunes, I don't necessarily want to have to use an iPod to play that. Why can't I play that on another device that I like better than an iPod?
But then how does the publisher or the retailer, in this case Apple, protect itself against the ease with which you can also just send it along to everyone you know, that they might send it along to everyone they know, and soon enough deprive the owners of, you know, any compensation whatsoever?
Well, that's kind of the argument that the record industry has used for a very long time, but it's very specious. I mean, when you look at most music sales right now in America, they're occurring in the form of CDs, and CDs are not locked with DRM. So if you go to a store and you purchase a CD and bring it home, you can rip it to your computer and share that freely.
When you saw the announcement that Apple and EMI were going to make all of EMI's catalog, minus the Beatles, available DRM-free, your first reaction was, hey, that's great. Looks like we've won this battle. But you're not quite as sanguine as all that. Tell me why.
Well, I think that one of the points about the whole thing with EMI and Apple that didn't really get across in most of the mainstream media was that this was kind of EMI's idea. EMI wanted to do this. And although Apple had made it pretty clear in February when Steve Jobs wrote an open letter to the industry stating that he kind of wanted everybody to embrace a non-DRM environment when buying music, EMI was really the kind of pioneer here. They were the ones who really took the risk. Apple makes almost no money on music sales on iTunes. They make their money, they make their margin on sales of the iPod and the computers that they're selling the iPod and iTunes with. Even if customers aren't paying a lot of money to buy music on iTunes after everything goes DRM-free, Apple's still fine because there's still a lot of music floating around out there. And I think Apple is banking on the fact that with DRM-free music, people are going to want to buy more iPods than ever.
Now, iTunes doesn't sell only music tracks. It also increasingly is downloading TV shows, I guess movies. What implications does this decision have for example, Disney movies? And I ask that in particular because when he sold Pixar to Disney, Steve Jobs got a very big stake in that company.
Well, you know, that's possibly one of the things that frustrated me most about the announcement this week was that Steve Jobs basically stated when asked whether or not they're also going to be transferring television shows and movies to DRM-free formats that no, that they wouldn't be because movies and television shows have never really been distributed without DRM. And that's just kind of the status quo for that industry. Whereas with the music industry, everybody buys a CD and that's unprotected. Unfortunately, that's just not true. Television shows are broadcast nationwide every single day, and there's no such thing as DRM for analog and digital broadcasts. Anyone can turn on a tuner and just grab a whole bunch of television shows that are floating around in the air and distribute them on the internet. And yeah, there's also the fact that Steve Jobs is in direct control of a number of record labels, television networks, and movie studios. And to date, although all of them, every single one, as far as I've checked, is on iTunes, none of them have gone DRM-free or have announced that yet. I think that there's a little bit of do as I say and not as I do going on here, but hopefully they'll correct that. And, you know, I will be more than happy to praise Steve Jobs the moment that all the Disney studios kind of go DRM-free as well.
Ryan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Block is the managing editor of the tech site Engadget.
Easter is upon us, and so is Kingdom Come. The book, that is. It's the latest and final installment of the hugely popular Left Behind novels. Since the first one was published 11 years ago, Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins have sold 43 million copies, not counting kids' books, movies, and a video game that have spun off the series. The books tap into a 200-year-old tradition among some evangelicals of reading the Book of Revelations as a literal playbook for the coming apocalypse. But before the world actually ends, the belief goes, the faithful will be raptured, summoned to heaven, and the sinners left behind will experience horrific suffering. And that's basically what happens over the course of the first 15 installments of Left Behind, as believers battle the forces of darkness commanded by the Antichrist in the form of a Romanian Secretary General of the United Nations. Finally, the Messiah returns to preside over a thousand-year reign of paradise on earth. It is here that the latest novel opens, a novel that co-author Jerry Jenkins says was not the easiest to write.
The big challenge was, if this is to be utopia with Jesus on the throne and David as his prince and that type of thing, would there be any sin or conflict, any crime, anything that would be grist for fiction? So I had to quickly try to get to the end and say, okay, Satan is now loosed again. He's amassing an army. He's fighting Jesus. You have to have conflict to have good fiction.
How literally would you say you're using the Book of Revelation? So are you just riffing on its themes, or are you directly putting them into modern language?
It's a little bit of the latter. If it's not in symbolic or figurative language, just as a matter of exercise, we take it as literally as possible. And that seems to have been what makes this series a phenomenon, that people tend to understand difficult biblical passages they didn't understand before because they were trying to understand them allegorically. And if you do that, you could probably get 200 different interpretations.
But there has been in recent years a sort of backlash against the Left Behind series, not just in the secular press, but among Christian thinkers, theologians who object to your reading of Revelations. They say that your portrait of a vindictive Savior who returns to earth to slaughter unbelievers by making their heads explode and their tongues dissolve in their mouths is just wrong.
Yeah, these are people either who haven't read the series or haven't read the Bible. I mean, we didn't make that stuff up. That is in the Scripture. And it isn't that he's vindictive. It's that finally it comes to the point where his patience has run out and justice is meted out, because for thousands of years he's tried to get people's attention. They've ignored everything else. And some people have said, well, would a loving God send somebody to hell? In essence, he's not sending anybody. He's inviting everybody to join him and go to heaven. And if they disagree and choose their own way, then that happens to be the result.
And so is that how you want your readers to engage with the novels, as prophecy, as inspiration, or as entertainment?
Really all three. I mean, we have never shrunk from the idea that we have a message. We believe these are true events that will happen someday, and we want people to be ready. Now, we realize in an age of pluralism and an age of tolerance that this can be a very offensive message, and you know, that a lot of people will laugh at it, a lot of people scoff, many will disagree. And you know, what they do with the message is really up to them. We're just glad we live in a country where we're free to espouse our views and we can compete in the marketplace of ideas.
So over the years, there have been a lot of attempts by the secular press to get their heads around the Left Behind phenomenon and its enormous popularity. What do you think the media most often miss or get wrong about the series?
Well, one of the things that I think has been really unfortunate is that I notice that some people who don't read the series hear what they think the series is about from other people, and they make judgments on our motives or on our feelings that are really incorrect. I mean, we believe that Jesus is the way to God, and we believe he said that. I don't understand why it's that way, and it might sound exclusivistic, and it might sound mean-spirited, and you say, well, what about well-meaning people of other faiths? That breaks my heart, and I know wonderful people that don't agree on this, and my fear is, from what I read, that I might not see them in eternity, and I want to. And so when people say, oh, these guys are gloating, they've got the answer, and somebody else doesn't, and they're going to heaven, everybody else is going to hell, that is a fear of ours, but it's certainly not something we gloat about and, you know, put our thumbs in our lapels and look down on people.
Given what you said the ultimate purpose of this series was, to warn people, to get them to change their behavior, did you ever feel the need to sort of dumb the story down or sex the story up in order to garner the biggest audience possible?
Well, first of all, the warning isn't to get people to change their behavior, because our theology is that it's not behavior that has anything to do with it. It's belief. It's whether you believe that Jesus is the way to God or not. And I've often said that some of the people that are left behind are nicer people than the people who go, but we're all sinners and some are saved by grace. But no, I never wrote these thinking about the audience or the size of the audience. When we first wrote it, we thought we had something special and it might sell 100,000 or 200,000 copies. But for it to cross over and sell tens of millions, people often say, how do you sit down and write a bestseller? You don't. If you think in that way, you're going to wind yourself in circles trying to do that. As far as dumbing it down, I've been criticized for being a pedestrian writer. I'll never be accused of being a literary writer. You know, I'd love to be smart enough to write a book that's hard to read, but I write for people like me. I'm a pedestrian reader. I love to read a good story that keeps me turning the pages. And so basically, I'm writing the story for myself and hoping there's lots of people like me out there.
Jerry, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jerry Jenkins is the co-author with Tim LaHaye of the Left Behind series. The 16th and final installment, Kingdom Come, hits bookstores this week.
At the peak of their popularity 6 years ago, the Left Behind books sold better than any other hardcover novel. Sales of the most recent book are expected to be much more modest. So where are the Christian media headed from here? An article in the current Rolling Stone suggests one answer. It profiles Ron Luce, the founder of an evangelical youth group called Battle Cry. For several years, Luce has been holding massive stadium rallies around the country that are part rock concert and part religious revival. In between shows, he runs a missionary boot camp in Texas called Honor Academy, where the most gung-ho are groomed for this spiritual war to come. The angriest man on the religious right is how the article's author, Jeff Charlotte, describes Luce. And Luce isn't toning down that anger for the sake of his media image. In fact, says Charlotte, he's playing it up.
Ron Luce is this brilliant media strategist who recognizes that, look, if I speak about war, if I say that media makers, in fact, are like Al-Qaeda, which he does in his book, Battle Cry, if I say these things are so sensational, I'm going to get a lot of attention and I'm going to grab the attention of kids. And what happens is these kids who don't necessarily understand that that's a media strategy come to accept that as a basic way of looking at the world. And so I spent about a week at Luce's Honor Academy in Texas talking with kids, and that was a normal tenor of conversation amongst the really sweetest kids who would sit there and gently tell you over a lunch of lasagna about the need to wage total war on secularism.
Okay, so these youths are rallied to war. What exactly is the war against?
The people that he focuses on most often are media makers. The one thing that Luce does differently is that he trains media infiltrators, and that's his term, is we want to infiltrate secular media. And so he created as part of his academy in Texas a really nice high-tech school for training kids how to produce media. He hired a VH1 Behind the Music producer who'd become born again to direct it. And at this point, these kids are, I think their biggest success was for a heavy metal band called Pillar that had a video on MTV. I think a lot of fans didn't know it was Christian. They're very aware that Christian media for decades was just awful and cheesy and it's just pure kitsch. And I think now they recognize that if we can produce really quality media, but that nonetheless has this fundamentalist message, then we're going to win kids over. If they can, you know, get to Hollywood and make movies that are actually pretty good, like the Chronicles of Narnia, those become the media equivalent of gateway drugs to bring you in to drink the full Kool-Aid of fundamentalism.
Now, you know, if the premise of Ron Luce and his teenage followers is that the media are the leading edge of the secular war against Christ, there could be no better example for them than the cover of the Rolling Stone in which your article appeared. Would you care to describe the cover of the Rolling Stone for me and what you thought when you saw it?
Well, we have Rosario Dawson and Rose McGowan, the stars of the new movie Grindhouse, and they're naked and rubbing their butts together, covering their breasts and other private areas with their hands and belts of bullets. And there's a big red headline that says, "Very Bad Girls." I have to admit, I took some delight in thinking of just how red with rage Ron Luce is going to turn when he sees this issue. You know, here's the thing. Look, is this cover sexist? Of course it is. Does it objectify women? Yes. And it's one of the interesting things about Ron Luce is that 80% of his critique of media is very similar to the critique I heard in my godless, demonic, secular, very leftist media history courses at college. It's the same analysis. Luce has a different solution. Luce just wants to destroy it. But even though there's this aggressive rhetoric, they're not going to go off and attack, you know, the headquarters of NBC. It's about teaching them to never look at NBC again.
So are they jihadists? Are they saboteurs? Are they moles? What is the vision?
I think they're moles and saboteurs who inspire themselves with the rhetoric of jihad. One video he made shows a kid watching MTV, and then crawling up over the couch behind him is a suicide bomber. And this suicide bomber represents secularism. And Ron Luce writes often that secularism and Islam are almost indistinguishable, that they're in this together to destroy Christianity. So the suicide bomber crawls over and then blows himself and the innocent boy up, the idea being that that's essentially what MTV is trying to do to you, is to kill you. And the response to that is to join this sort of military maneuver, and then the videos will show, here's you marching off to war, and suddenly the boy replicates and replicates. And so now we have an army of 1,000 identical boys marching. It is, and I use this word very advisedly, it is the aesthetic of fascism. Ron Luce isn't a fascist, but it is the aesthetic of fascism. And one of the strange things about Ron Luce is it's also the aesthetic of Stalinism, these red flags that they wave, and you're not a member of this movement, you're a trench mate. It is designed to draw very stark lines and to dehumanize those who are on the other side.
It sounds monstrous. Is there any benign way of viewing this?
Yeah, there is. A lot of these people are there not because they hate the world so much, but because they want to be engaged with the world. Unfortunately, Ron Luce and his angry rhetoric are the ones who get to them first. And I feel like the sort of the benign read of this is if someone goes and talks to them and says, look, you know, we care about you too, and we want you to feel proud of what you believe in and so on, but that doesn't have to be framed by hating other people. I think these kids respond to that beautifully and brilliantly. These are some of the gentler and kinder kids I've met. They don't want to be in a war, but that's all they're being offered.
All right, Jeff. As always, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Bob.
Jeff Charlotte wrote about the group Battle Cry for the current issue of Rolling Stone.
Coming up, more tumult at the LA Times and the secret salacious epistle of Samuel Clemens.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Sam Zell offered, and the Tribune Company accepted. Or, more accurately, Tribune came knocking, and Sam Zell agreed. Either way, the Chicago real estate magnate is on his way to owning 23 TV stations and 11 newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune, the Hartford Current, the Baltimore Sun, Newsday, and most prominently, the Los Angeles Times. That paper has seen more than its share of high-profile shakeups in recent years. There have been scores of newsroom layoffs and resignations by top editors. But tomorrow is another day. Or is it? Tim Rutten is the media columnist at the LA Times. He says a new owner may not be the cure-all some people are hoping for.
It isn't exactly as if a lot of fairly bright people haven't been thinking about these problems for a long time. Newspaper managers and newspaper company managers have been in a sort of traumatic crisis of confidence for a long time now. They can't quite figure out. They can't see the future, and it makes them nervous. So they're always looking for somebody to come in from outside, some different perspective that's going to, you know, bring the answer in. And there's some of that in the reaction to Mr. Zell's purchase of Tribune.
The LA Times, on one level, is in the same fix that all large newspapers are. They're facing plummeting circulation, a dramatic drop-off in classified ads. On the other hand, there's also your paper's ongoing soap opera that probably has nothing to do with the troubles that ail the rest of the industry. I mean, it seemed to begin when Times Mirror brought in an outside publisher from a consumer products company, General Mills, thinking that it needed new blood. And you got some new blood, all right.
You're referring to Mark Willis, who came to Times Mirror having been the number two man at General Mills. And he was full of all sorts of, you know, wisdom gained from the packaged goods trade. We got long talks about the different ways that they'd increased, you know, the sales of Betty Crocker cake mixes. So that was that era. But unfortunately, the first thing he did for us was to lay off 1 in 10 of my colleagues. That was pretty much his contribution, except for the notion that he was, as he liked to say, going to break down the walls, which meant essentially he wanted to eliminate the separation between the advertising and editorial departments, which he found extremely inconvenient. When he didn't get much sympathy for that, he and some of his colleagues went off on their own and negotiated a secretive arrangement in which the owner of the local sports arena, the Staples Center, was able to share in the advertising revenues for an edition of our Sunday magazine that was devoted to the opening of that building. Of course, nobody on the editorial side knew that had happened. That was, I suppose, the beginning of the soap opera. I mean, I was thinking, you know, in preparation for this interview, in the last 7 years, the Los Angeles Times has had four editors and four publishers in 7 years.
You know, so much for stability.
Yeah.
Now, you did a piece recently in which, you know, for all of the problems that plague the LA Times, you seem to place the blame squarely in one place, and that is on the Chandler family.
Well, you know, the Chandlers are a funny family. They're unlike, say, the Grahams or the Sulzbergers. Both the Grahams and the Sulzbergers have a kind of steward's ethic toward their newspapers. They understand that while they're obviously businesses, they're not only businesses. The Chandlers always had a problem with that concept. The Chandlers' ethic, if you will, is more like a California developer. You know, they just sort of strip things and move on.
Now, it could be the end of the year before we find out if Sam Zell actually does acquire the Tribune Company and the LA Times. So far, you know, what's your guess? Does he have a sense of noblesse oblige, or do you think he's just a guy out there trying to make a fast Chandler buck?
Well, I don't know about how fast. He says he's a long-term investor, but I take Mr. Zell at his word, and he has said that for him this is a purely economic opportunity. So if you think that the problems at the Los Angeles Times over the past few years are a product of an excessive preoccupation with high profits, we'll have to see what he thinks of as a reasonable return. There is a great deal of talk continuing that Sam Zell may, in fact, spin the Los Angeles Times off to one of the local billionaires who's expressed an interest in buying it, David Geffen.
Well, whether David Geffen or whether Sam Zell, as someone who is a student of the newspaper business of long standing, do you believe that the words investment opportunity and newspaper business really belong in the year 2007 in the same sentence?
Sure. Look, there are going to be newspapers around for a very long time, but the successful ones are going to be hybrid news organizations in which there's some sort of amalgam of print and online presentation of the news. It's clear that there are going to be some things we will continue to do best in print, some things we're going to do for our readers online on a 24-hour basis, and people will survive and prosper through this era because the most ingenious of all human qualities is avarice, and there's a lot of money to be made here.
All right, Tim. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure to be with you.
Tim Rutten is the media columnist for the LA Times. We'll read a few of your letters in a moment, but first this update. We've reported on Josh Wolf, a blogger arrested and jailed for refusing to give federal prosecutors videotapes he made during an anti-globalization protest in July of 2005. He was released this week after spending 226 days in prison, the longest any journalist has served for protecting source materials. Wolf had maintained that the prosecutors intended to use the tapes not to find lawbreakers, but to identify protesters. He was freed after reaching an agreement with the United States Attorney's Office to submit raw footage of the demonstration, but he will not have to identify any of the people he filmed. Meanwhile, he's posted the whole videotape on his blog.
You sent us quite a few letters this week, most on our interview about the upcoming Terror Channel sitcom called Jihad to Be There. Tony Commons wrote in to say it was, quote, very funny. I do hope that next week you'll tell us just how many OTM listeners thought it was real.
Well, judging from the mail, not too many, but a few, including one major news organization north of the border. Most of you realized at some point that it was an April Fool's Day stunt, though some of you had to Google just to make sure. The response was mostly positive, ranging from brilliant, hilarious, and nicely done to tasteless, racist, and insensitive.
Among the naysayers was Alice M. Curtis, who, after noting that all the characters in our fictional sitcom were named Abdul, had this to say, quote, I am a counselor in an elementary school where we really do have a lot of boys named Abdul. I cringe to think of our children being subjected to this kind of cultural assault. Our local NPR station aired this story on April 1st. I thought it might be a hoax, but since the program originally aired on March 30th, I'm afraid it might be true. If it's all a joke, it's just not funny. And if it's real, I'm not laughing.
We also received a lot of mail regarding my interview with journalist Nina Easton, who talked about the benefit of being married to a political consultant. Listener Joan Budd gave us a good laugh when she wrote, quote, congratulations on an excellent April 1st hoax. I'm sure I'm not the only listener who was initially fooled by your interview with Fortune's Washington Bureau Chief Nina Easton on the important topic of coziness between political reporters and those they cover. However, when Ms. Easton referred to media critics as navel gazers while being interviewed on a media analysis program, well, that was just too arrogant to be believable. And your dry response was the final giveaway. Well done.
Keep those jeers and cheers coming to On the Media at WNYC.org, and please tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. On March 1st, 1882, Boston District Attorney Oliver Stevens wrote a letter to the renowned publisher James Osgood regarding the delicate matter of a new book that was deemed to be in violation of the city's statute against obscene literature. Osgood took up the matter with the author, urging him to remove the offending poems and passages in order to appease, quote, the official mind. The author refused, and the book, Leaves of Grass, was pulled from publication. It turns out that James R. Osgood and Company had also issued The Prince and the Pauper by Mark Twain, who was moved to defend Walt Whitman against what he thought was arbitrary censorship. Twain dusted off the old canon, found offensive passages by Shakespeare, Swift, and a dozen other lights of literature, and penned a letter to the editor of the Boston Evening Post.
A century or so ago, the foulest writings could not soil the English mind, because it was already defiled past defilement. But those same writings find a very different clientage to work upon now.
Twain argued, slyly, that just because a book was harmless 100 years ago, it doesn't follow that it's harmless today.
If you will allow that the question of real importance is, which are more harmful, the old bad books or the new bad books, permit me, then, to institute some comparisons.
Twain went on to cite the offending passages inside of Rabelais, Boccaccio, Shakespeare, et al. But you've never seen this letter to the editor in any Twain compendium because it was never published. In fact, it was never sent because it was never finished. It will appear for the first time anywhere in the current issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review, introduced and annotated by Ed Folsom, professor of American literature at the University of Iowa.
From our perspective now, looking back on Walt Whitman and Mark Twain, we're looking back on the discoverers of a democratic form and a democratic voice.
What makes their work democratic?
They began to break the traditional conception of the author speaking as authority over the people. Walt Whitman worked very hard in Leaves of Grass to construct a voice that would speak what he believed all people eventually would speak, even though no one could yet speak that voice, including him in his own personal life, but he could imagine that voice. Mark Twain, on the other hand, turns a novel over to a relatively uneducated 14-year-old boy, a boy speaking to us in the dialect of the common people.
You note, though, that Whitman didn't always have kind words for Twain and vice versa.
The thing that Walt Whitman did not like about Mark Twain was that he felt in some ways Mark Twain was playing at being that Democrat that we just talked about. He was playing at being a writer of the people when in fact he was living a quite elegant and privileged life, unlike Walt Whitman, who was living in a tiny little home in dirty industrial Camden, New Jersey. Mark Twain was living in his mansion. He was a society figure mixing with the most famous people of his time, talking to presidents and so on. Whitman, I think, always felt a little democratically superior, if that's not an oxymoron, by being the person who was actually living the life of the people.
But if Mark Twain was playing at democracy, he was playing with very serious intent when he wrote that satirical letter to the Boston Evening Post. How did the alleged obscenity of Leaves of Grass come to the attention of the Boston DA?
Well, this was the time of the now infamous figure Anthony Comstock. Anthony Comstock was a reformer who wanted to get rid of filth and obscenity in American life. part of the effect of the Comstock Revolution was that medical schools had problems for a while even getting textbooks because Comstock would get these laws passed that would make it illegal to send any lascivious material defined as material showing naked bodies through the mail. He made it his mission to set up societies for the prevention of vice, as they were called. And one of the strongest was in Boston. That Society for the Prevention of Vice got started about 9 or 10 years before they finally scored their big catch by getting Leaves of Grass ruled obscene.
But what about Leaves of Grass in particular was deemed offensive?
Well, there's the famous Section 5 of Song of Myself that begins, I mind how once we lay such a transparent summer morning, how you settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me and parted the shirt from my bosom bone and plunged your tongue to my bare-stripped heart and reached till you felt my beard and reached till you held my feet.
Oh, stop, stop. And so Twain set out in his own inimitable way to puncture the notion of what was deemed offensive. He writes,
I think I can show by a few extracts that in the matters of coarseness, obscenity, and power to excite salacious passions, Walt Whitman's book is refined and colorless and impotent, contrasted with that other and more widely read batch of literature.
So what are some of your favorite of these extracts that Twain used in his letter to the editor?
Twain uses, of course, two sets of extracts. One set of extracts are the extracts from Leaves of Grass itself. I keep as delicate around the bowels as around the head and heart. Copulation is no more rank to me than death is. I love Twain's comment on that passage. He says, it does seem unnecessarily broad, it is true, but observe how pale and delicate it is when you put it alongside this passage from Rabelais, 13th chapter.
Go ahead and read a little bit of that Rabelais.
Sure. How is that? Said Grangousier. I have, answered Gargantua, by a long and curious experience, found out a means to wipe my bum. The most lordly, the most excellent, the most convenient that ever was seen. What is that? Said Grangousier. How is it? I will tell you by and by, said Gargantua. Once I did wipe me with a gentlewoman's velvet mask, and found it to be good, for the softness of the silk was very voluptuous and pleasant to my fundament. And on and on and on.
It seems to me, though, by quoting Rabelais and Boccaccio and even Casanova, he's sort of stacking the deck. You know, when he says to the putative editor of the Boston Evening Post that all of these books are likely to be on your own bookshelf, do you think he was speaking the truth?
He mentions a lot of books right at the beginning of the letter, including Tom Jones, Joseph Andrew, Smollett's work, Byron, Burns, Gulliver's Travels, he quotes from. And I think the interesting thing is that Twain knew that newspapers would censor whatever he wrote that would verge on the obscene. And so in this unpublished letter to the editor, Twain very carefully begins the passages and then he just marks little asterisks for the rest of the passages. And he always then puts a little bracket imagining how it would appear in the newspaper, and in that bracket he would have little statements like, we are obliged to omit it, editor post. He could make his point precisely because the reader would be intrigued enough to actually go get those books off his shelf or go to the library and get them. Twain's point was, they're readily available. I'm going to get you started by telling you, here's a really dirty passage in Rabelais. Now you go look it up.
Now, Twain's letter ends with a tantalizing fragment. He writes, Whitman's noble work.
Yeah, my favorite part of this letter is its unfinished nature, because Twain was very sensitive about a number of people who had made comments like, well, what you're doing in fiction is sort of what Walt Whitman did in his poetry. And Twain bristled at the idea that he was imitating someone else's ideas. And so what lingers in that little fragment is Mark Twain's affirmation of the nobility of Whitman's work, something that he never affirmed that directly anywhere else. Whitman's noble work.
It was a pleasure talking to you, Ed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Ed Folsom is professor of American literature at the University of Iowa. His annotated version of Twain's letter, titled The Walt Whitman Controversy, is in the current issue of the Virginia Quarterly Review.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Christopher Worth, Peter Garner, and Arun Roth. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.